Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and happy Friday. So nice you've joined me this morning as you're just getting your day started. Looks like it's going to be a wet and chilly weekend here in the upper Midwest, but I don't know what's going on in Hartford. You could be still enjoying that lucky fall warm weather. I need to check out what that is. So anyway, the new iPhone is coming out today. People are lining up at Apple stores like they've got nothing else to do. All right, I'd like one of those phones, but here's what I get nervous about. It has new Face ID technology that allows users to unlock their device by merely looking at it. See, I'm afraid my smartphone would go, oh, not you again. That would probably be a big bummer. So I don't know if I'm going to get that. Plus, there are $1,000, $999 for the basic model. And if you want memory and other features, it's probably going to be more. So I hate headlines. Headlines throw me off. Here's a headline. It said, farmers urged to buy... Bill, why don't you try reading it correctly? Here we go. Let's try again. Farmers urged to bury underwear to improve beef quality. I went, oh, I don't want... Oh. And then I had to read it. And it said, farmers are being told to do that because a Scottish farming board said that burying a pair of briefs for 2 months in a pasture can reveal key details about soil health. Apparently, the underwear will remain intact if the soil is sterile. But if the soil is healthy, the underwear will be eaten away and the only part of it will remain is the elastic waistband. Good soil conditions are said to directly impact the quality of beef and the quality of feed that beef and sheep eat and ultimately produce a tastier cut of meat. So I guess it's a way to measure soil quality.
The more you know.
The more you know, the more disturbed I am. And let's see, the president's on his way to Asia for a couple of weeks, so that'll be interesting, getting out of the swamp, they say, out of Washington, D.C. But before I bring Carmen LeBurge on, I want to start off with the real story of the day, which is Colossians 2:8. That says, see to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depend on human tradition and the elemental spiritual forces of this world rather than on Christ. Let no one take you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy. That's a way to start the day. It's 6 minutes after the hour. We'll bring on Carmen LeBurge. We're going to reconnect with Carmen in just a minute.
Birds are singing just outside. Here comes your mercy streaming in with the morning light. My heart's racing, waking up to your smile and saying, good.
Good morning. It's 8 minutes after the hour. So glad you are with me this morning. People in New York are remembering the victims of last week's deadly terror attack. A vigil was held at the site where police say this guy, I won't say his name, drove his rented truck down a bike path, killing eight and wounding nearly a dozen. Mourners expressed sympathy and sadness for the victims, but also vowed not to give in to fear. Now, I think that's a good story to start my conversation with Carmen LeBurge. She is from Reconnect with Carmen show. And a regular friend of Faith Radio and my regular Friday morning guest. Good morning, Carmen.
Good morning, Bill.
Well, when do we call this thing terrorism? How about immediately?
Right. And so when we use the word terrorism, I just think it's important for us to remember what the word means, what it derives from, and that specifically in the culture in which we live, it actually does have a specific meaning. And so you might have some folks wonder, well, why is one event called terrorism and another event is not called terrorism? Where does that designation come from? There is a legal designation of what is and isn't terrorism. But I also want to talk about the more, I guess, general cultural sense of what is and isn't terrorism. And so a terrorist is somebody who is not just trying to create a mass casualty event and do some grave or great harm, but somebody who is also trying to send a particular message. And they are actually the ones controlling that messaging. So it's about, you know, it's about telling a story. It's about creating a storyline. And so we might juxtapose what happened in Las Vegas, which certainly seems like a terrorist event. It certainly struck fear into the hearts of people. It made people wonder whether or not we should go to outdoor gatherings. And but here's the reality. We actually still don't know what the motivation of the shooter was. We still don't know what he was trying to communicate or the story he was trying to tell. The difference with the New York situation, we know exactly what this man intended. We know exactly why he intended to do it. He's waived his Miranda rights. He's speaking freely about it. And it's very much focused on ISIS and the ISIS agenda. So that's really the delineating line. And I think that Christians need to know that so that we can be people who talk about these things, not with any sort of religious hysteria, but with a knowledge of what's going on globally in relationship to people who are motivated out of a very specific theological agenda.
So New York would be considered terrorism, but we don't really know yet about Las Vegas.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Carmen, what about the expression enemy combatant? Of course, when the first time I heard that, I thought, well, this guy would certainly be an enemy combatant, but I think that has a qualification as well as far as being on the battlefield in like a theater of war. Do I have that right or wrong?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. So I think that when we elevate ISIS to the level of having enemy combatants, we're actually suggesting that they do have more power than they have, that they're more well-organized than they are, that they actually have geography to defend, that they are, in fact, a nation state. They are not. Let us be very, very honest that we're talking about a terrorist network of individuals. We are not talking about a nation state against whom we could actually identify. There's no geography for us to go and say, hey, let's get rid of the people controlling this particular place, because from this particular place, terrorism is being sent forth into all the world. The conversation about whether or not North Korea is going to be designated as a terror state, that conversation is ongoing. People are going to hear that in the news over the next few days. That's what this is actually all about. Can we point to North Korea and say, from this geography, terrorism is going forth from an organized nation state? And if so, then we give it that terrorist designation, and it kicks in all of these restrictions related to import and export and commerce and all kinds of things. So all of these conversations are intertwined, and language is important, and we need to be careful about the language that we use. Enemy combatant is a part of that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Seeing how we're being schooled in terms this morning, Carmen, what about Allahu Akbar?
Okay, so you're going to hear, in fact, people are hearing conversation about this phrase a lot. You hear Allahu Akbar used in by terrorists when they want to communicate a very particular message. What they are trying to communicate is Allah is great. That's actually the direct translation of that. You will hear it or see it translated as God is great. That's actually confusing terms, in my view, because we're over-identifying Allah with God in general. And so I think that what we need to recognize, we're talking about a very specific God, that it's Allah is great or Allah is greatest. And it's actually a very part of the regular rhythm of Muslim prayer. Muslims actually say Allahu Akbar many, many, many times during a given day, not only in the course of their five set times of prayer, but anytime they feel grateful about something. And so it's a very, very common phrase for all Muslims. It has been weaponized. It has been a very specific meaning has been attached to it when folks like this man in New York choose to use that phrase as an indication of the ISIS narrative or the narrative related to any sort of Islamic jihad. And so it's become a jihadi phrase. And I would say that there are lots of Muslims who will say, hey, that's the co-opting or the weaponization of a phrase that, you know, that means something much different to me as a Muslim. And so those are the conversations I think Christians can engage in with their Muslim neighbors. They can say, what does that phrase mean to you? Mm-hmm. I hear it in the news. What does it mean to you? And allow people to tell their own story.
And Carmen, even we said it differently. I can't even remember what I said. Did I say Allahu? And you said Allahu?
Allahu Akbar.
Okay, so
well, and I
knew one of us would get it right.
Well, and I don't speak with enough of a Middle Eastern accent at all to probably say it in a way that is honest to the way that folks in the Middle East hear it.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you encourage us to engage in conversation with Muslims in our communities, when was the last time you had a conversation with a Muslim in your community?
In my community, let's see, probably two Saturdays ago at the grocery store.
Okay.
I actually find that in terms of engaging with women, Muslim women in conversation, the grocery store is a great place to do it because it's one of the places where they're sort of free of the constant supervision that many of them live under otherwise. And it's also a place where we can talk about whether or not, I should buy this onion or this melon, and they can assert a level of expertise that I may not have. I've learned more about produce and when it's ripe and good from Muslim women in the grocery store than anything else. So, that is more of a cultural touch point, trying to simply engage a person in a conversation about something they're already doing than something specifically theological.
It seems that they're less likely to engage or make eye contact with men in grocery stores because
you can't speak to a Muslim woman.
That's
right?
What
so
I
there's
mean.
There's all kinds of cultural. Yeah. So there you probably as a man have all kinds of opportunities to talk with Muslim men that you may not even be aware of. But literally, depending on where people live, get Uber to come get you sometime. you will be overwhelmed and surprised at the percentage of Uber drivers who are not Christians. They may not, be Muslim, but many of them are not operating out of a Christian worldview. So I find taxi drivers and Uber drivers a great opportunity to engage in conversation.
Interesting. All right, Carmen, let me take a break. I'll come right back more with Carmen LeBurge in just a minute. It's 17 minutes after the hour. We are back. It's 19 minutes after the hour. Speaking to Carmen LeBurge from reconnectwithcarmen.com. Carmen, as I'm looking at all these Russian ads that had an influence on the 2016 election, how do we wade through all these stories and the power of media, especially social media? I'm just trying to figure out how we can discern the truth from the lies.
Yeah, so you're not alone in that. I think that is the conversation of the day related to this particular story. Folks who may not be completely up to speed, the Russians made very wide use of social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter during the 2016 election cycle. And actually, Bill, I think what's most astonishing is they're still fully engaged. They're still fully engaged in these efforts. And they're not so much trying to influence the outcome of the election in one direction or the other, it doesn't seem, because there's now evidence that they were posting things that were as much anti-Trump as they were anti-Clinton. And they're still engaged today, seeking to provoke division in our culture. So the things that they are working on today are about racial, driving a wedge among us racially, and continuing to drive a wedge on deeper on issues where there is a disagreement in our culture. This is important for folks to recognize that we have a foreign power seeking to use platforms that we as Americans have built, social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter, and they are seeking to actually make us enemies of ourselves. And so I think that that's the starting point of the conversation for Christians. Like, we actually know the enemy. We know that the enemy is real. We know that the enemy sows seeds of divisions among us, and that work is something that's been going on for a really long time. I mean, in terms of the actual enemy, I'm talking here about the devil or Satan. Mm-hmm. His latest pawns and his latest Ponzi scheme happen to be the Russians seeking to drive wedges of division here in the American culture. But Christians can actually participate pretty actively in these conversations when folks are like, just amazed that anybody would do this. You can just be like, okay, this is not new. This is a new way. This is new technology, but this effort to drive division into homes and hearts and communities and countries, this is not new. This is the devil. And so part of it is making sure that We make those spiritual observations in conversations when others would not, when others would be less inclined to make spiritual observations. We need to be the people who make those observations. But I think that your question is really, how do we discern the truth from lies? How do I tell when something is fake or real? And I think that part of that is we have to slow down in terms of our consumption of social media and our desire to so quickly click on something in terms of retweeting it or liking it on Facebook or reposting it on our own social media platforms. People need to remember that that social media platform that bears my name and my likeness is a representation, because I'm a Christian, it's a representation of God. And so is this something that God would be liking? Would God be reposting this on his timeline? And if not, then as a Christian, I need to stop myself. As much as I might want to post something salacious, I have to stop myself and say, that is not going to represent God well.
Yeah. And God wouldn't have a timeline. He'd have a timeless line, right?
He would. He'd have a time. Exactly.
Right. So was the DNC rigging the election for Hillary all along? This kind of sounds that way.
So for listeners who don't know, Bill's talking here about Donna Brazile and her accusation.
And Elizabeth
very
Warren.
Public accusation. Oh, and Elizabeth Warren. Yeah,
she
very
joined
public
in too.
Accusations. Yeah, very public accusations that basically the Democratic National Committee rigged the primary so that Hillary would be the candidate and not Bernie Sanders. Anyone who is surprised by that has been like asleep in terms of politics for a long time. I think there's no question that that's precisely what happened. And I think that, you know, ultimately they got exactly what they engineered. If you don't allow the democratic process to freely work, then you shouldn't be surprised when, you know, your efforts to control it fail to produce your preferred outcome. The democratic process really does need to work freely and produce whatever outcomes the people want. Now, then we have to live with those outcomes. And sometimes that's very, very difficult.
Now, did the Democratic National Party believe that Bernie Sanders was a Democrat? Or did they go, well, wait, he's a socialist?
So these are definitions, I think, that are pretty fluid in terms of our cultural conversation. We actually have a whole generation of the next generation of Americans, younger than you and I, Bill, who think socialism is a good thing, who think socialism is better than capitalism, who think socialism is the way that we should go in terms of healthcare. That's because they don't understand what it is and what it produces. That's because they don't believe that Venezuela is a socialist country. That's because they don't know the names of Stalin, Marx, and Lenin. They just don't even know what those. They don't know what happened in history as an outcome of socialism. So part of it is educational in terms of our own culture. But I think you're exactly right. I think that political insiders on the Democratic side, they want to preserve the DNC in the same way that folks on the Republican side want to preserve the RNC, even when the RNC is out of touch with a lot of Republican voters. So too, the DNC is out of touch with its own base as well. So I think we've got probably a season of pretty revolutionary change coming. And I don't use that word casually. Mm-hmm. I think we have pretty systemic change coming in terms of the politics of the United States, and Christians can participate in that with a distinctively Christian witness, regardless of whether or not that means you vote red or blue.
Carmen, I give my guests two casual revolutionary changes a year, so I know you're not using this.
Well, that's good. I'm glad we only have a couple of months left, because that means I get to two more new ones
exactly.
in 2018.
Exactly.
All right.
And I also read 50% of millennials would be okay with living in a socialist country.
Yeah, that's because they don't know what that means. I mean,
I literally
have no idea what they're talking about. Yeah,
they just need a little bit more education.
Well, so every Christian who's listening right now who has influence in the life of someone who is, let's say, 30 years old, because when we're talking about millennials, we're not talking about kids anymore. We're talking about young adults.
Right.
So somebody that's in their 20s, you need to have a conversation with them about socialism. You actually need to ask them, what do you think it means? And can you point to a socialist government in the world that has actually benefited its people?
Good point, Carmen. This is why I always love talking to you, because you always stimulate me to action. So I appreciate that.
That's good, man.
Yeah,
hey, have
totally
a great
good.
Day.
You too, Carmen. I'll talk to you again next week. It's 27 minutes after the hour. We'll take a break and listen to Ken Davis and lighten up. Be back in a minute.
Feel free to stop by on your way to work. The Early Morning Late Show with Bill Arnold on Faith Radio. If the front door's locked, use the secret knock.
Good morning. It's half past the hour. Coming up after the news, Dr. Rosemary Stein from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. Dr. Rose is going to talk about schools with bully prevention actually have more bullying. We saw that coming. Anyway, we'll take a break and be back in a minute.
Hi, I'm Ted Ross with the Faith in Life Minute. If you and your family are running from one activity to the next, listen to this encouragement from Dr. Linda Mental on how to slow down and get balance back into your life.
If you're just running from activity to activity and you just feel like you're the taxi cab mom or dad who's just constantly on the run and it's too much, then a lot of times I'll say to families, just cut something out. Just decide you're not going to do it. Learn to say no and bring back the family meal. If the schedule is so crazy that people can't even eat one meal together, you really need to rethink that, because the benefits of eating a meal together are absolutely astounding. If you did that, your kids would do better with nutrition, with academic performance. They have a lower risk for delinquent behavior, and that really seems to me like a really small price to pay for some really big results that can make things so much better in your family.
Find more healthy tips for your family from Dr. Linda Mental at myfaithradio.com.
We're sharing each day together.
The world is not helping our faith increase, but Faith Radio presents us with truths, and our soul needs nothing more than to have the truth presented on such a regular basis to encourage us, to lift us up, to let us know that we're not alone in the midst of our trials. So Faith Radio is a lifeline to me, and I know that confidently if people are seeking the truth, it's invaluable to just developing fellowship and communion with the Lord.
Thanks for being part of the family of Faith Radio.
Good morning. It's 24 minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold here enjoying the feel-good response from caffeine. In the meantime, Dr. Tim Muehlhoff says that people want techniques they can use when confronting someone. Tim says what we really need is a change of heart through spiritual disciplines.
We want to say, hey, just give me five techniques. I don't particularly like this person. I don't particularly respect this person. I'm just kind of angry at them, but I know that that's probably not the best way to start. So give me five techniques to make this a good conversation. And I want to say, well, there's no technique about the heart. So I suggest the spiritual disciplines that the church has always practiced, like prayer, solitude, confession, fasting. I suggest to people all the time, boy, you should be fasting as you head into this conversation. When you have negative thoughts about this person, we submit it to the Lord. And we say, Lord, I confess to you that I have a really bad attitude towards my spouse right now, and I need to deal with that before you walk into that conversation, because if you don't, you have inadvertently sabotaged the conversation.
Every time I hear Dr. Tim Muehlhoff, I kind of, my ears perk up a little bit. He's an interesting guy, and if you want to hear that entire interview, head over to myfaithradio.com. Muehlhoff is kind of a tough one to spell, M-U-E-H-L-O-F-F. Or type in working, conflict, grace, truth. Type in those words and you'll see Dr. Tim Muehlhoff. We'll take a short break and then Dr. Rosemary Stein's with us.
Harry Potter's influence goes unchallenged in most homes and churches. That's definitely got my attention. This is Jim Garlow. The article from a Barna survey said this: a majority of teens, Christian or otherwise, are ingesting the mythology of the child wizard without any guidance from their parents or church leaders. Educating our children biblically is our responsibility as parents. Proverbs 25:2 says to encourage your children to seek out and understand the mysteries of the universe. That points towards a creator that is all-knowing, all-loving, and merciful. To paraphrase Mark 8:36, what good is it if all the money in the world were applied to educating children, if in so doing, they lose their very souls? Train up your children soundly, firmly, biblically. There's more at jimgarlow.com. Well, it's Friday, so weekend's right ahead of us, which is good. And the doctor is in her office right now with me. It's 20 minutes until the top of the hour. Dr. Rosemary Stein from the Christian Medical and Dental Association. Good morning, Dr. Rose.
Good morning, Bill.
You know, this is an interesting conversation I want to have with you this morning because it's about bullying. And I want to talk about this because I have a hard time drawing the line between where kids are trying to be lighthearted and fun-loving, and they're trying to find their little sense of humor in life, and then actually when they cross the line, and now they're just being mean and they're bullying.
That's exactly right. And, you know, by trying to eliminate bullies, just like gun control, we take people's ability to cope with the problem and to not be harmed away. In essence, have done by having all these anti-bullying programs, because we're not dealing with them from the right perspective, is that we have strengthened the person who is the bully, the person who's at risk because something is terribly wrong at home and is very angry and wants to lash out constantly. And it's not that this person is evil; it's just that they have these very poor coping techniques. But because of what we are doing in our classrooms and in our society, we're strengthening that person with that coping mechanism that they're using.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really bad for our kids. And what we're doing is, on the other hand, we're weakening the ones who need to understand how to stand up for themselves and how to have a self-dignity about them.
Yeah. I mean, if you just were to Google Bill Gates, age 15, I promise you'd see a picture and you'd go, oh, does this kid get bullied?
That's right.
Just because he just looks like the king of nerds. And who's laughing now? You know, I think there is something about bully prevention programs, and I can't imagine they're going to be that helpful, because every time you try to put a magnifying glass on something to eliminate it, all you do is make it bigger.
Well, and think about this, the fact that you have a bullying prevention program at school makes it so the parent doesn't think that they have to train that child and teach that child how to cope with bullying because, oh, they were already doing it in school. And so for a lot of parents, they sort of turn their back on that problem and they're not talking to their children and asking them, you know, how are things going in school? How are you dealing with kids that might be pushing you around? Well, they have that at school, so we don't have to talk about that. And that's what leads down this path.
Yeah, you know what I never hear ever discussed is ways in which you have conversations with kids about their sense of humor. That's something that they're going to need to understand how it works and how to use it. And I mean, I remember like in grade school calling, you know, a friend that got glasses four eyes. I thought I was the next Don Rickles.
And it was very original, too.
Oh, totally. I think I called him a hockey puck by the end of the day. So, I mean, I was off and running. But the whole idea that when do parents sit down and talk about humor constructively with their kids? What's good humor? What's negative humor? What's mean? What's gentle? You know, the difference between self-deprecating humor, where you're making a little fun of yourself, versus you're making someone a victim and you're going after them as the target of your ridicule, which you think is funny, but is in reality kind of hurtful.
Absolutely. As we're just not taking the opportunity to talk to our kids and to build good people at the end.
So I think I'm going to start my 3-day seminar for parents. For $699, you can guarantee a spot today. Anyway, well, let's talk about the narcissism and what kids are doing now and how they're growing into narcissism just because of what we're doing or not doing for them.
Well, the self-esteem sort of society and thought that we have had for the last 30, 40 years is really harming our kids, because instead of teaching them humility and treating others as you would treat yourself. We're teaching them that they're the most important creature on Earth. And guess what? Kids already have the tendency to think that because, you know, they're toddlers. They're only thinking about themselves. They're not going over to even the person who they love the most, mom and dad, and saying, Mommy, how do you feel today? It just doesn't happen. So when we feed the self-esteem and ego of a toddler and they believe that they are the most important person in the universe, well, they feel very unhappy irritated, frustrated when that place is taken away from them because, you know, the world happens.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're doing to our kids. And then they grow up in that same mentality. I am the most important person in the world. And you see it daily as you're driving down the street and you realize, well, there's another narcissist. And it's really bad for America.
And then also they can have a brazen, unearned self-confidence because all they do is get, you know, puffed up from people. And I think you got to learn some hard knocks. You got to navigate your way through some difficult things in life. And then that way you can build your own self-confidence based on how you responded to stuff.
And these people who are that narcissistic are very weak because they have not dealt with any setbacks. And their only way to cope with them is to indeed bully. And the narcissists are the biggest bullies of all because they only have one button to push, and that's to push other people around to get their way. You can see there was a YouTube video about a legislator up in New York who was given a ticket. And she went into a 15, 20-minute rampage on the trooper and tried to bully herself her way out of it and cry and just about threw herself on the ground. This is what happens when we teach our children that self-esteem is a virtue, when indeed it is not.
See, I've done all of that. Cry, lay on the ground, try to get out of tickets. So, no, I know what you're talking about. Dr. Rose, let me take a break, and then we'll come back and continue our conversation with Dr. Rosemary Stein from the Christian Medical and Dental Association, 14 minutes away until the top of the hour. Good morning. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm speaking to Dr. Rosemary Stein from Christian Medical and Dental Association. And this was an interesting story, Dr. Rose, in Durham about a Catholic emergency room nurse that sued Duke University because they had violated the anti-discrimination law by refusing to accommodate her moral objections to abortion and birth control.
And we see a lot more of this going on, but we see very few standing up for their faith and their values. So I commend this nurse because she's a very, very brave young lady. But what's going on is that they are teaching in our medical schools and in our places of training for medicine that you are erased of your faith, of your values, of the things that you hold dear, because the patient's values are more important than your values.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, the patient is kind of looking around to see, to get that core and a guidance from you. But if you have none, then that person who's seeking from you will just choose what is convenient. And so what we're constantly battling is a worldview that is anti-God and anti-truth with one that is truth. And this lady stood up for truth. And we must do that in our lives all the time. But what I have seen in Duke, because we're very close, we're about half an hour away, and so we do have their students from time to time, is that Duke is training up their students to be more sort of, let's say, robotic, more just basic technicians of medicine, and not to incorporate anything personal at all in themselves, and this is what that yields, where it's just a machinery, and we're on a bad path in medicine and in culture if we continue this on.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Rose, if you were interviewing young medical students just graduating, going into the profession, what would be one of the primary things you'd be looking for in today's field of medicine?
Well, my first question would be, what inspired you to become a doctor? Because the thought is still that this is something that's going to take a lot of your time. You're going to give a lot of yourself. This is something where you risk your own family life, in a sense. This is a vocation, a missionary, a sort of, even if it's you're not a Christian, you are giving your life, and that's not the thought that you have. But even more than that, I would ask them, what do you plan to sacrifice so that you become a doctor? And do you understand how much pain you're going to be in to transform yourself into a true physician if you are to become one?
Mm-hmm. One of the thoughts I had was how good are you, or how competent do you think the person would be with their own bedside manner? I'm thinking, if I had to get some bad news about my health, I'd like it coming from you.
Well, and there's a lack of empathy and compassion. Not that medicine has to be just that, but I will tell you, Bill, that it is about 40 to 50, if not more, percent of that. The patient actually, when I talk to them and I just look in their eyes and I tell them, honey, it is going to be okay. I feel like those words are medicine, and they are on the path to getting better.
I mean, it actually worked on me, and as far as I know, I got nothing wrong with me right now, but you saying that on the air made me feel better. So,
and it wasn't really directed at you.
I know, but I was just thinking about a specific patient. I took it all in. So saving America one child at a time, do we have a story we can continue hearing about?
Absolutely. So I was thinking about the bullying theme that we had going.
Yeah.
We had a story a few weeks ago, and this is a very similar story, but a different boy. And he had come in maybe about a month ago with the problem that he was bullying at school. And this is a very large boy, and he was bullying mom and his brothers and sisters at home, in throwing these huge temper tantrums and trying to get his way so he could eat, so he could not do his homework, et cetera, et cetera. And I told mom and dad, you have to stand in his way and teach him that it is your way or the highway, in a figurative sense.
Mm-hmm.
And they took him home and I said, that just start there and start with chores and teaching him that he will not have a place at the family until he obeys the rules and then does his chores. And watch his schoolwork get better and his relationship with his friends get better, but also go into the school and tell him that you are straightening him out. Well, it's just been, I think, about 5 weeks. He just came in this week. And the kid is smiling. But at the same time, he's telling me, things really change at school. So I'm not pushing the kids around, and I feel a little bit better. But because I'm not pushing them around, they came back and they started bullying me. Dr. Rose, what do I do? It was very interesting because these kids have no mechanism to take care of themselves once you take away the button of bullying others. So I said, Jules, you're going to set your shoulders straight. You're going to look at them, and you're going to look like, really? I mean, you're like, think about it in your head. You're half my size. You're bullying me?
Yeah.
And he laughed because he realized the truth in that. And so it's a sense of everybody has a virtue and a strength. And you have that child find that. But in the middle of that, they have to understand their dignity and their worth. And so when I told him, you are a very important young guy, and I love it that you improved so much, and you're going to go back to school, and you're going to look like you are a strong young man. And when you do that and you give them that look of, I could have you for lunch and walk away, then you have become strong.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm going to do that, doctor.
Yeah, here's a line to give him, Dr. Rose. You're going to bully me? You and what army?
That's right. And it's not bullying them back, but it's just having that confidence and that dignity that just it just wipes out a bully, and they have nothing to they have no weapons left.
I call it creative hassling. You just sort get back and you get creatively kind of hassle them back, and all of a sudden they feel like, oh, okay, I'm down on different playing surface now.
You'll be amazed how quickly they grow disinterested in you.
Oh, I know. So I'm just curious, are there any parents that get to the point where they're kind of afraid of their kids?
Yes, absolutely. They are, and so that's what strength it gives that kid that's bullying more and more strength, because they start to back off, and mm-hmm. the kid understands, if I do this and this, then my parent won't bother me anymore, and I'll be left alone to do, you know, to feel good about it. And that's a very dangerous place for a kid to be.
Yeah, so parents really have to stand up to the kid if he's especially bullying at school, and not let them do any of that at home.
That's right.
Okay.
That trains the child for a very long time. And when that kid has bullied, you make sure that you go back and that you are strengthening that kid in techniques that are the right ones, but also will lead that child to have the confidence in their good qualities that they need to have.
Awesome. Dr. Rose, it's always great to speak to you. Thank you so much for being on the show. I'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
You have a great 2 weeks.
Yep. Have a nice weekend. It's just about 3 minutes until the top of the hour, and we're going to come back and have a great second hour. We're going to have Adam Holtz, and then Laura Mulliken is going to be with us. So stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute. All right, that wraps up hour one. Thank you to Dr. Rosemary Stein. Always enjoy her perspective. Bullying, what a big issue that still remains today. We're going to work on that. As followers of Christ, I think we need to be kind and tender-hearted toward one another, forgiving each other as God has forgiven us. So we've got a great second hour coming up. Stay tuned. We're going to have Adam Holtz give us some movie reviews, and then Laura Mulliken. Be back in a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend, and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.